Test, test. Can y'all hear me okay? Not much of a podium person, just because I'm going to move around a lot. The camera is probably going to have some trouble with me today. But as Mark said, it has been over a year. Last time I was up here to teach God's Word was with my beautiful bride, Frances, and that was the summer of 2024. And of course, I have the passage about Jesus getting angry and flipping over tables, so it's no easy or light passage, actually pretty controversial stuff, so we'll see how it goes. It might be another year before y'all invite me back up here, but if you are new here, if you haven't gotten a chance to quite meet me yet and you enjoy today's sermon, my name is Jimmy, and if you don't like today's sermon, my name is Scott, but before we dive in, I actually need Ezra and Jonas and Francis. Hey guys, I need your help real quick to help me with something. So these are my beautiful kids, my oldest, Ezra. This is Jonas, my wife, Francis. And Ezra, I need your help. What do you want to tell people? Say it right there.
There is a baby coming.
Good job. Buddy. Good job. You did it. Yes, we are expecting baby number 3. And as you can tell, I'm doing a lot of hard work. So, maybe due date in March sometime. So, yeah, there we go. Best way to grow a church, right? All right. Well, thank you, guys. We could talk more and chat later and celebrate more. So, there's a photo of like a calm Jesus, angry Jesus. Eli, if you can throw that up there. So, we kind of always see like, oh, Jesus is kind of like this super cool, sweet, calm, collected guy. And then today we're seeing this Jesus who's just all anger and flipping over tables. So before we actually really dive into the text, I do need to pull the car over for a second for us. And from a counselor or counseling perspective, help you guys understand anger before we kind of go into this. And there are actually two misunderstandings about anger, and when something's misunderstood, sometimes it's misused or misdirected. So let's kind of get our understanding straight. So one approach, one misunderstanding to anger would be that anger is bad. Anger is wrong. So this would be the person that when they feel mad, when this person feels anger, they feel a deep sense of guilt. They feel a deep sense of shame, saying, I shouldn't feel that way. It's not right for me to get mad. It's not right for me to be angry. And to give these people credit, they actually quote Jesus or use Jesus to justify this emotion. If you guys remember in Matthew, there's this popular sermon that Jesus gives called the Sermon on the Mount. And in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, anger is equivalent to murder. So these people say, okay, I shouldn't feel this way. Being angry is equivalent to murder. But, as we all know, I mean, the favorite pastime of Christians and non-Christians alike is taking passages out of context. Who loves that, right? In that context of Sermon on the Mount, what Jesus is talking about, he's talking about preventing reconciliation with your brother or your sister. Specifically talking a refusal to forgive, that we are going to stiff arm and gatekeep any hope of us finding peace between you and me. I will withhold my forgiveness if it means getting back at you, if it means getting even with you. That's what Jesus is talking about. That's the kind of anger he means. But the other wrong approach to anger, so one side thinks that anger is bad, the other side thinks that anger is good, in a sense that when they get angry, they can just blame shift it over to anger. They say, have you ever kind of been with somebody who kind of like they said a hurtful thing to you, they did a hurtful thing to you, and they said, what? The anger got the better of me. I was just being controlled by my anger. It wasn't me. I was just angry. Which is an apology. We're supposed to understand that. And what they're doing is they're essentially creating some kind of straw man. They're creating a scarecrow and personifying anger. They're saying, it's not my fault that I said those mean things to you. It's not my fault that I did those things to you. It was whose fault? It was anger's fault. But anger holds no moral value. Anger, just like any other emotion, holds no moral value. It's neutral. It's not good or bad. It's just an emotion. And here's what emotions are. Emotions are data. It's data. It's info. Okay? Now, what you decide to do with that data and what you decide to do with that info, you can use it for good or you could use it for evil. Okay? But when you are angry, when someone's angry, you can ask just two great questions. What are you angry about and why? And the answers to those questions are going to reveal something in your heart. Why am I angry? What am I angry about? It's probably something that you deeply care about, something that you value, and you're going to discover things about you. Or maybe it's another person. You ask them, hey, why are you angry or why are you upset? And hopefully, if that person trusts you, they can share something about what they care about. And this is just kind of, this is for free. This is kind of free counseling, free advice. You should always be a student of yourself and be a student of your spouse if you're in a relationship. Always be curious to ask those kinds of questions because those answers will dig up and reveal something about you. Now, in today's passage, we're going to be in Mark chapter 11. So if you want to join us on the YouVersion, you can go on to the YouVersion app, go to events. You'll see our journey notes there. Or I like to say, it's just the good old-fashioned Bible. I love that Dylan always lugs around. Where is it, Dylan? Show us that sucker, man. I got to see this from afar, man. Look at this. Look at this catch. Yeah, I see Renee's Bible back there. That's a Bible. That is a B-I-B-L-E right there. Okay, so we're going to be in Mark chapter 11, and we're going to be starting with verses 12 here in a second. But before we jump in, I need to tell you what's something that's called a Markin sandwich. Markin sandwich. I should have a slide there. Thanks, Eli. You're the man today, bud. So a Markin sandwich, Mark does this a lot through his Gospel of Mark. And it's just like a sandwich. There's going to be a bread slice, there's going to be filling, and then it's going to finish off with a bread slice. So if you've been with us like in our Bema groups, Marty Solomon always likes to point out things called chiasms. And it has like a little repeating pattern, right? Like A, B, C, and then C, B, A. This is kind of like that similar concept. So a couple examples real quick. How does Mark do this? He does this one time earlier in Mark 3 with Jairus' daughter. And Jairus is this religious leader. He's prestigious. He's someone of importance and someone of authority. His daughter is dying, not dead yet, but is dying, goes to Jesus, says, I need you to help me. And Jesus, just like an ambulance, right, we're rushing over to go save this girl before she dies. Now, Mark interrupts that story. And Mark interrupts that story with the story of a woman who had been bleeding or hemorrhaging for 12 years. And Jesus stops the ambulance, helps this woman that no one cares about, no one's looking at, helps her. And then Mark goes back to the original story, which is Jairus' daughter. And the big question you ask in that story is, why would Jesus stop the ambulance? Ambulances don't stop. Jesus does. Why? Because she matters just as much as this guy of importance and stature and authority and leadership. Jesus is going to help you no matter what. That's what Mark is saying in that sandwich. In another sandwich, there's a story where Jesus sends out the 12 disciples. He sends out the 12, and then that story gets interrupted by the beheading of John the Baptist. Goes back to the sending of the 12, and we would ask the question, why does Mark put the beheading of John the Baptist in the middle of evangelism, in the middle of these disciples being sent? And that's because when these 12 disciples graduate to 12 apostles, what's going to be their fate? It's not a happy ending. I'll just kind of spoil it for you. All save one are going to die some pretty gruesome deaths. These are what Mark and sandwiches do. And today's Mark and sandwich, he starts off the story with a fig tree. And he's going to end the story with a fig tree. But in the middle, this is really about the temple. This is kind of like, you know, when your spouse is like angry over the dishes. It's not really about the dishes, right? It's not really about the fig tree. This is really about the temple. So if you want to join with me here, Mark chapter 11, we're going to start here with verse 12. And it says, on the following day, when they came from Bethany, now Bethany, that's where his friends Mary, Martha, and the recently resurrected Lazarus, that's where they live. So he's staying with his friends. Jesus was hungry and seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf. And he went to see if he could find anything on it. And when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. And he said to it, may no one ever eat fruit from you again. And his disciples heard it. So, little interesting things to know about me. Back in the years of PK, and PK, by the way, stands for pre-kids. In the days of pre-kids, I was a very avid collector of craft beer. Used to collect lots of it. Rarely rare and hard to find bourbon barrel aged beer. And I would collect it just like anyone would collect maybe wine, collect bourbon. It's just collecting. And I had so much that I had collected, I actually had an entire refrigerator full of these craft beers that I had through the years collected. Now, those were in the years of PW. Now, does anyone want to guess what PW stands for? Pre-wife. Yeah. When I got married, Francis said, no, you need to fit it all in this little mini fridge now. So anyway, to get these hard-to-find beers, liquor stores would have special, what they call cellar sales. And these sales would start generally around maybe 7 or 8 a.m. So what you would do, you would show up the night of, get a little folding chair, and you'd sit out there all night. And a lot of other people are doing it too, by the way. It's kind of like Black Friday. And I sat out there one time, and I was maybe like fifth or sixth in line out of like 20. And it was great. You sit out there, you talk to people, you know, get to know people. And then the store opens. We all rush in. Only for me to be the one last person, like the next person in line to not get the beer that I was looking for. Which makes waiting all night not worth it. I was so disappointed to keep it PG-13. I was pretty disappointed. Now, some of y'all in this room, do you guys remember a day when you'd show up to the movie theater and all the tickets were sold out? Do you remember having to like, oh man, I think I need to get tickets for the 6 o'clock showing and it's only like 11 a.m. right now, right? Or you show up to the movie theater and say, hey, you know what? Sorry, that movie you want to watch, I got seats in the very front row. You want to sit there, right? Nobody wants to sit in the very front row, right? Everyone in this room, you know what it feels like to show up and be like, I'm looking for this and it's not there and I'm so upset about it. Jesus is hungry, which is so cool that the Bible's very authentic and transparent about Jesus's emotions and his humanity. He gets sleepy. He sleeps on a boat. He gets hungry. All right, we get so caught up that Jesus is God, yes, but Jesus is man. He's hungry. He's looking for food. And in the distance, what does he see? He sees this tree, and it's full of leaves. Does that look healthy? Yes, it's a healthy, it's promising a snack. It's got this, all this, it's got all this promise. And he shows up, and what does he find? No fruit. No fruit. Is this really about Jesus being hangry? Is this really what this text is really all about? And I'm going to argue that there's at least two reasons why this is not about Jesus being hangry. Number one, do we know that Jesus can endure hunger? How do we know that? Went 40 days without eating. Didn't make the stones in the bread. So we know homeboy is okay without eating for a little while. And then secondly, Jesus is without sin, meaning he is not controlled by his appetites in the same way that you and I are controlled by our appetites. Whether that's an appetite for money, if it's an appetite for control, if it's an appetite for affection and attention, you and I are controlled by all kinds of appetites, but not Jesus. So no, this is not about him being hangry. No, I'm going to tell you that Jesus was already angry when he woke up this morning, and I'll prove it to you. I'll prove it to you. Eli, give me the next. This is the verse right before the fig tree. This is Sunday. What I'm preaching on today is Monday. But there's something that Mark touched on last week on Sunday's Palm Sunday. What does Jesus do? He entered Jerusalem after that donkey ride. He entered Jerusalem, and he went into the what? He went into the temple. And he looked, and he saw everything. He saw all the abuses, all the wrong things happening in his father's house. I think Jesus was hot the night before. I think he woke up angry. And he goes and he sees this fig tree. And I don't think the fig tree helps. And this is what we know about Jewish rabbis. Jewish rabbis, and Mark has said this before, will almost often find the closest object to use it into a parable. If I'm going to teach you an idea, if I'm going to teach you a concept, I'm just going to pick the most random, the closest thing to me, and somehow I'm going to use that as an illustration, right? Jesus is like, look at this kid, right? Look at this field. Look at this tree. This is how the rabbis taught. This is not about the fig tree. He's using the fig tree as an object lesson for what is happening at the temple. Does that make sense to you? So what is happening at the temple? Before we can answer that, there's actually a problem. Now, if you've been with us in the Bema groups, what does Marty like to do? He always likes to go looking for what? Problems. There's a problem in this text. So I want you to go back to the next slide, Eli. Go back to the Mark. It should be the next slide. I put it up there twice. Okay, I'll read it for you again. On the following day, he came from Bethany. He was hungry, sees in the distance a tree in leaf. There's leaves. Went to see if he could find anything on it. He came to it, found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. And he said, may no one ever eat from you again. Is Jesus' disappointment justified? Is there something in this text say it louder. It's not in season. Does that sound fair to anybody in this room? Jesus, you're going to go look for fruit. It's not the season for fruit. Is that okay? Is that fair for Jesus to be upset if it's not the season for figs? Isn't that a problem? It's a little bit of a problem. Yeah, I'm not making this easy on myself today, huh? No, that was a problem when I was studying this text. I'm not going to lie. And for this next part, I got to give credit where credit is due. Okay? There's an excellent study on the book of Mark by Tim Keller, and it's called Jesus the King. And this really cracked open the text for me. And what Keller says is the Middle Eastern fig tree is different than the fig trees that you and I know. The Middle Eastern fig tree actually produces not one, but two kinds of fruits. So Eli, can you throw up the next one, the picture for me? Okay, in the springtime, which would be right around this Passover time, in the springtime, the Middle Eastern fig tree will grow these little nodules, okay, these little nubs. And sometimes, this is not an always case, but even sometimes, these little nubs of fruit will show up even before the leaves do. Even before the leaves do. And you could pick off those little nodules and you can eat them. It's totally fine. And it would sustain you. Now, these little nodules that can show up even before the leaves tells you this. You could go up to a Middle Eastern fig tree, and if it had no leaves, there's a possibility there might be fruit on it. But if the tree had leaves, there's a guarantee that those little nodules are on there. So that's why Mark emphasizes, not once, twice he mentions the leaves. Now, is Mark just getting paid by the word? He's emphasizing the leaves because this emphasizes the promise this tree was giving. If there were leaves, oh boy, there was fruit. There was fruit. The temple is not producing fruit. The temple is up to all kinds of disappointing stuff. And now we're ready to look at the temple. So Mark 11:15, they came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple, and he began to drive out those who sold and those who bought in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers, the seats of those who sold pigeons. He would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. And when he was teaching them and saying to them, is it not written, quote, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations, but you, can you hear that? He's like, can you feel that? He's like, you have made it a den of robbers. And the chief priests, the scribes, they heard it and they were seeking a way to destroy him. For they feared him because all the crowd was astonished at his teaching. And when evening came, they went out of the city. So what's happening here, this is the time of Passover. And like Mark said, all the Jews around the region, they're all collecting into this central place, the temple. And there's a place in the temple. Eli, go ahead and show us a picture of the temple. There's a special place in the temple that's called the Court of Gentiles. Court of Gentiles. And now this was a place that originally was in God's heart to allow both his people and those that were not called his people in that time to come together to experience the true worship of the true God. It's the Court of the Gentiles. And at this time of Passover, there's at least two kinds of offerings that are going to be taking place. One is called the burnt offering. This is called the olah. Right? So in this burnt offering, this is often for general sin, or could also be used for dedication. You might remember this young couple, Mary and Joseph. They went to the temple with pigeons to dedicate Jesus. That is the olah. Now, the other kind is the chatat. This is the sin offering, right? You're going to offer a lamb, you're going to offer a goat, a bull, and this is for unintentional sins. So people are showing up to the Court of Gentiles. They're going to the temple. This is the time of year where we're going to sacrifice. And yet there are a number of abuses. Here's the first abuse. Notice in the text, he kicked out the money changers. The money changers. Now, why would there be money changers? Because people who are traveling from far away, it's hard to bring your pet with you. Has anyone have pets? Have you ever traveled? Do you normally take your pets? Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't, right? Usually you gotta call up a neighbor. You got to call up a friend, family member, and say, hey, I'm going to be gone in a couple days. Can you watch so-and-so? It's hard to travel with your goat, with your lamb, with your bull. So you say to yourself, hey, we're going to travel to Jerusalem, take some money with us. We're just going to buy our sacrifice when we get there. And you show up with your money, and they say, oh no, we don't take MasterCard here. You need our Jewish money to buy Jewish things. But hey, it's okay. We'll help you. You can change your money, and we'll give you the right money. But what is going to happen? My brother's here today. Lonnie, what do you think is going to happen?
They're going to take a spread.
Yeah, yeah. They're going to add a little fee. Yeah. You guys ever go to ATM? Right? You go to ATM, you need cash. It's an ATM that doesn't belong to your bank, and they say, hey, John, we're going to charge you $3.50. Is that okay? No, but you're going to say yes anyway because you need that cash. Yeah, they were taking, listen, here's the point, jokes aside. They were using the status of foreigners against them. They were using, abusing, exploiting someone's foreign status against them. Take their money. I don't think Jesus is thrilled about that. So that's why he goes after the money changers. Now the second one is that he kicked out the sellers. He kicked out the sellers. So now you got the right money. You're going to go and you're going to buy your sacrifice. But guess what? You're already in the temple, so we're going to mark up the price. All right? You ever try to buy lunch at Disney World? McNutt family, I'm looking at you. All right? How much is just a soda at Disney World? I don't know, more than they pay me at Journey, probably. I mean, it's just... You ever try to buy popcorn at the movie theater? Why can they do that to us? Because you're already here. They can mark it up. So not only are they taking money through the money exchange, they're taking money by marking up the price of these animals. Because they know if you are going to go and make peace with God, you're going to have to give us a spread. You're going to have to give us a cut. Do you see? Is it clear how they are robbing people and they're using God's name to do it? You can see why Jesus is probably a little not happy. Now, an example to show you too, just real quick, just to really just drive this point. Why does Mark mention the pigeons? Mark specifically goes out of his way to mention pigeons. And here is why. In Leviticus, when God sets up the offering system, are bulls expensive? Yes. Lambs and goats, are those pricey? They are. So the poor would have no way of offering sacrifice to Yahweh. So what does God do? He says, you can offer two doves or two pigeons. And that was something God set aside for a specific people group. For a specific people, the poor. And yet there's this first century rabbi, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, I think. Let me see if I'm saying that right. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Okay, he was kind of the ruler of the Sanhedrin just before the destruction of the temple in 7 AD. He records, now I feel like Mark looking through all the Hebrew stuff. He records that the pigeon was being sold for one golden denarii. One golden denarii. And yet, in a text from Jesus, you guys might remember Jesus saying, he says something like this. You ever hear Jesus say, are not two sparrows sold for a copper coin? The pigeons used to be cheap because it was meant for the poor. But this rabbi is saying they were sold for one golden denarii. That is 25 times the amount for a pigeon. Like, we want to talk about mark up. Imagine paying 25 times more for gas than what you're paying right now. Maybe got your attention. So, yeah, it was pretty abusive. And who were the ones causing this abuse? The Jews, but specifically the high priests. The Tosefta, is a companion text to the Mishnah, and the Mishnah is like kind of the oral law, okay, for rabbis. Tosefta says that the high priest would put their sons as the treasurers in the court of Gentiles. They say, it's like the mafia, okay? We're going to put our family in the right places of authority, and we're going to tell everybody else, if you want to do business here, you got to cut us a little something something. Okay, the high priests were like today's mafia, and everyone knew the high priests were dirty. There's a first century historian named Josephus. Okay, he's Jewish, but he writes history for both Jews and Rome. And this is what Josephus said. You can put up there, Eli. Josephus says, "And now it was that the high priest, taking the opportunity of the troubles, did all of them procure places for themselves of great authority. They also sent their servants to the threshing floors to receive the tithes that were due the priests. And those that did not give them, they beat and oppressed, so that the poorer priests, who had nothing to depend on except the tithes, would starve to death." Just to give you a little outside the Bible evidence of how the high priests were so twisted and so corrupt that they were even beating the priests who serve in the temple. They didn't care who you were. They were going to get theirs. Den of robbers. Den of robbers is what Jesus is doing. He is quoting the prophet Jeremiah. And here's what's interesting. I mean, this is true. I mean, history repeats itself. History repeats itself in the Bible, too. 600 years before Jesus is flipping over these tables, God raised up Jeremiah, and he told Jeremiah, I need you to stand at the temple. And these are the words I need you to say. Go ahead and throw up Jeremiah 7, Eli. And Jeremiah says, "Hear the word of the Lord, all you men of Judah who enter the gates to worship the Lord, Yahweh. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your deeds, and I will let you dwell in this place. Do not trust in these deceptive words. This is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord." You guys catch the repetition? Temple of the Lord, temple of the Lord, temple of the Lord. Now, why is that repeated three times? Most scholars agree the reason why Jeremiah is repeating temple of the Lord, temple of the Lord, temple of the Lord was because there were 3 days out of the year that Jews were obligated to go to temple. Okay? One time, they're supposed to go during the Festival of Booths, also known as the Festival of the Tabernacles. You got to go then. The other time you're supposed to go is Pentecost. That's going to be 7 weeks after Passover. And the other time they had to go to temple was during the Passover, which is right now. Temple of the Lord, temple of the Lord, temple of the Lord. This would be equivalent to us today, right? You got to go to church when? Easter, Christmas, and probably mom's birthday. That third one's a toss-up. Okay? Temple of the Lord, temple of the Lord, temple of the Lord. What is this saying? Jeremiah is saying, You think that you can just do the bare minimum, you just show up and say the right things and do the right things, that you're okay with God? You have the appearance of health. You have the appearance of being right with God. But just like the fig tree has the appearance of a promise, God says in Jeremiah, you're fooling yourself. You're kidding yourself. I don't have time to show you everything in Jeremiah, but he does go on, Jeremiah. He'll say, you in my house are abusing the refugee. You're abusing the orphan. You're abusing the widow. And you come to my house and say, we're good? God is saying, you don't care about the same things I care about. It's important to God. It should be important to us. And Jeremiah is going to continue. if you want to go on, Eli, to the next Jeremiah, he says, behold, Jeremiah says, you trust in deceptive words to no avail. Will you, here's the kicker, will you really steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, make offerings to Baal, and go after other gods you have not known? And then come and stand before me, which is in my house, which is called by my name, and then you're going to say, we are delivered. Only to go on doing all these abominations. Here it is. Has this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your eyes? Behold, I myself have seen it, declares the Lord. This is a strong word. It's a strong word. 600 years before Jesus. Jesus is quoting Jeremiah. The rabbis, the high priests, do you think they know the book of Jeremiah? Yes, they have Jeremiah memorized. Okay? If I could sit down and watch Tommy Boy with my brother, me and my brother, I guarantee you, him and I can quote every line in that movie. It's our favorite movie. Just watch it if you haven't seen it. The rabbis could quote every line from Jeremiah. So when Jesus shows up and he says, you have made my house a den of robbers, they know where Jesus got that from. They know the context of which Jeremiah was hinting at. They're self-deceived. They profess with their mouth and they deny by their lifestyle. It happened in Jeremiah's day, happened in Jesus' day. Does it happen in our day? Many, many. We know how to say the right things. We know how to put up the act. We know how to dress. We know how to shake the right hands. But how does that show up in our lifestyle? Are we like the fig tree? All leaves, no fruit. So we got to go back to the fig tree. We got to go back to the fig tree. Mark 11, verses 20 through 25. As they passed by in the morning, so now this is Tuesday. As they passed by in the morning, they saw the fig tree withered away to its roots. Let's just pause right there. You know, I've gotten a chance to sit with this text all week, and you haven't. Sit for a minute with the words withered away to its roots. I think it's such a haunting, terrifying word to be withered away to your roots. This is Tuesday. On Thursday in the upper room, during the Last Supper, Jesus is going to bring back another analogy of the vine. And he says, every branch in me that does not bear fruit, it's only good for one thing, making a fire. Because when you're withered away to your roots, you are dead. You are useless. This tree is useless. And I think at the very least, no matter how you guys are hearing this or what you guys, this should at least cause pause for us. I can only be up here and speak for myself. I do not want this. I do not want this for myself. I do not want to be withered away to my roots. I do not want to be made useless in the kingdom of God. And Peter thinks this too. That's why Peter is going to say next. Peter remembered and he said to them, Rabbi, look, the fig tree that you curse has withered. So Peter's asking the right questions. Oh my gosh, look what happened. And Jesus is going to answer him, have faith in God. Truly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, be taken up and thrown into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that he has what he says will come to pass. It will be done for him. So what Jesus is doing here, this whole like being withered away to your roots, Jesus is not here telling you and me, do more. Try harder. He's saying, trust deeper. You guys hear that? Peter's asking, I don't want this. I do not want this being withered away. I want to be fruitful. What do I need to do? And Jesus isn't telling him, just be more active. Just do more. Just give more. Prosperity teaching. No, Jesus is saying, trust deeper. But trust him for what? Now, this was the hardest part of me prepping this week. I texted Mark, and I was like, what's the fruit? Because we're trusting God for the fruit. That's what he's looking for. Didn't find it at the temple. Didn't find it at the temple 600 years ago in Jeremiah's day. That temple got destroyed. Jesus didn't find it at the temple in his day, and 37 years later, that second temple would be destroyed. How do we trust God for fruit? What is the fruit? And I think the text, I just didn't go on enough to read it, is to read the rest of this text. Jesus says, therefore, and by the way, anytime you see the words therefore, you should be asking yourself, what's it there for? Therefore, I tell you, whatever you ask in prayer, believe that you have received it and it will be yours. And whenever you stand praying, forgive. If you have anything against anyone, so that your Father also who is in heaven may forgive you of your trespasses. What is the fruit? I got to ask this question. When Jesus showed up to this temple, he said, my house shall be called a house of what?
Prayer.
Prayer. He shows up because this is supposed to be a house of prayer. Now, there's something I didn't point out the first time, I'm going to point out now, is that when Jesus showed up, flipping the tables, it says he kicked out the sellers. But we often gloss over the lullaby effect. He kicked out the sellers and the buyers. He kicked out the buyers too. And we want to pause and say, but aren't the buyers the victims? Yeah, they're the victims. But is this a house of buying and selling? What is this a house of? This is a house of prayer. So Jesus isn't necessarily against the buying your sacrifice part. He's just saying, don't do it in my house. Do it somewhere else. But you don't do it here. Because my house, which is called by my name, shall be called a house of prayer. Now, I got to tell you a little something about prayer. Okay, the low-hanging fruit answer to prayer, okay, is prayer is talking to God. And that's not a wrong answer. Prayer is talking to God. But I'm here to tell you that prayer is so much more than just talking to God. Okay, prayer, hear me well, prayer is communion with God. Prayer is being connected to God. And I've gotten to talk to quite a few married folks in my counseling time. And every struggle, every problem is a little bit different. But I always tell them, no matter what, every couple, every relationship has the same goal. You all, if you are in any kind of relationship, and it, by the way, it doesn't have to be a romantic relationship. This applies to friendships. Okay? Everybody's here for one thing. You are in that relationship for one thing. We all want the same thing, and that is closeness. You want to feel close to your spouse. You want to feel close to your friends. You want connectedness. You want to feel connected to your partner, to your spouse, to your friend. That's what prayer does. It helps us experience connectedness, helps us experience closeness with God. So when Jesus says, my house is a house of prayer, he means so much more. doesn't he? He says, people are coming here, and the purpose, the fruit of my house is that you come here to feel connected to God, that you come here for communion with God. But you are getting in the way of people feeling connected to God, you den of robbers. You're not just robbing their money. If only it were just money. These people are robbing something so much more valuable than money. They are robbing people from experiencing God. And how do we do that? How do we rob ourselves from experiencing God? How do we rob others from experiencing God? And Jesus gives one really great example. He says here, and let me quote you again, the therefore. Go ahead, you can go ahead and put that back up, Mark 11:20. Right, what's the therefore, therefore? Let me read Jesus' response. Whatever you ask in prayer, believe that you have received it and it will be yours. And then he says, whenever you stand, what? Praying. You need to what? Forgive. Now, you don't see this in the English text, okay? In the Greek text, there's something, these things called imperatives. And imperatives are just fancy words for commands. What the command is, in Jesus' words, is not just praying. Praying's an aside. The focal point is always on the command, the imperative. The imperative is in forgive. All right. It's unfortunate the English language just doesn't do this. If we had like a Spanish translation, the Spanish language has a conjugation for imperatives. You know in Spanish when you say something in the imperative, it's abre la puerta, right? I'm commanding you to open the door. Forgive. When you and I withhold forgiveness, we are stiff-arming and gatekeeping people from experiencing God, and you're also keeping yourself from gatekeeping and experiencing God. Dad, you don't have to record. It's already being recorded. I know. Some things never change, huh? Here's a funny thing. I need someone with the Bible. Rafi, I'm going to pick on you. I need you to read for us verse 26, please. Verse 26. Can you read verse 26? Wait, say that louder, Rafi. You don't see it. You don't see it. And you won't see it. Isn't this cool? Dylan, do you have a verse 26 in your Bible? What happened? What happened? Isn't this interesting? I'm like a magician now. It's not a verse 26. Now, because the older manuscripts didn't have what was on verse 26. Later manuscripts, 5th century, had this. They quoted Matthew 6:14. So go ahead and throw up Matthew 6:14. Matthew 6:14 is verse 26 in some manuscripts. So Jesus is really concluding the fig tree with this. He says, for if you forgive others their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive others their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive you of your trespasses. It's a super heavy word. And by the way, this Matthew 6:14, this comes at the end of the Lord's Prayer, right? We love the Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, yada, yada, yada. Well, after he's done teaching you the Lord's Prayer, Jesus says this. If you forgive others their sins, your heavenly Father will forgive you. But if you do not forgive others, then neither will your Father forgive you. Prayer, communion with God, the fruit that he wants to see in me and in you. You can't have the fruit if without a willingness to forgive. I don't want to stay here too much because I'm afraid of what I'll say. How are we stopping people from experiencing God? Us, today. And I was like, oh, you know, sometimes, you know, churches, they spend their budgets in all the wrong ways. We have prosperity churches that are asking people to give because if you give, God's going to bless you. But all they're doing is building nicer churches and communities that are dirt poor. I could go that route, and that's applicable. But when I really think about how we stiff-arm people, I can't help it. I got social media. And every time I flip up open social media, I dive right into this political war. And I don't want to get overly political, but I'm going to get political about politics here. This us versus them, and this them versus us. There's a reason why here at Journey Church, we have made the decision, okay, that we don't wave the any one flag of any political party. And I've talked to Mark, and Mark's talked to me about this, and we know that if we really wanted the size of this church to explode, we know how to do it. We know exactly how to make this church grow more. All we need to do is endorse a certain political candidate or political party. And we've seen it, right, Mark? Many churches have grown because of it. And I'm still roughly new. I've only been here 3.5 years. But I can only imagine that before my time, I'm sure people have left our church because we don't take a stance on any one side party. And I love Journey's decision that we don't, and here's why. Not in my house, says the Lord. Discussing politics, is that a good thing? Yes. Should we be debating, discussing, dialoguing? Should we be having these hard conversations? Yes. But don't do it in here. Do it somewhere else. Look, guys, if you want to know what I think about Charlie Kirk, I'm happy to tell you. It's going to cost you a coffee or a beer, but I'm happy to tell you, okay, outside of here. But when you and I show up together, and I'm not talking about the building, right? We know church is not the building. We are the church, that we don't hold something against someone else because of what they believe about XYZ. When you and I show up here to be together, okay, it's to experience closeness, you and me and you. We're here to feel connected together so that collectively we can be connected to who? God. Whose name? His name is on this house. Okay, not Donald J. Trump, not Joe Biden. It's his name. And we come here to be with him. And we want, don't we want others to experience this too? So let's stop getting in the way of our fruit. I do not want to be withered to my bones. I want us to experience fruit. I want to invite the band up. I want to invite the band up because I want to end with this question, which is a question, it's a good question. It's a question called why. That's what I love about kids, man. Sometimes they ask why too many times. Why should you and I be motivated to forgive? Why should you and I be motivated to live at peace, even at peace with those we don't agree with? What's the motivation? This tree, this fig tree, it was diseased. This tree was corrupted, had leaves, no fruit. This tree was cursed. Let me read something for you. It's not up on the screen, but this comes from Galatians 3:13. Christ redeemed you and me from the curse by becoming a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone who is hanged on a tree. This fig tree was cursed, and yet it will be Jesus himself who will take on him. He will carry a tree. He will climb up Golgotha with a tree. And he's eventually going to be nailed to a tree. And the curse that you and I deserve does not fall on you, but on him. In John chapter 2, there's another cleansing of the temple, only this time Jesus has a whip. Takes a whip to the temple. And yet we know in Passion Week, who's going to take a whip to Jesus? He's going to take a whipping. He's going to take the cursed tree. Guys, why should you and I be motivated? It's really simple. It's really easy. It's because you and I were forgiven. Let me say it again. You and I were forgiven. Therefore, why can't we forgive someone we don't agree with? Why can't we forgive someone who annoys us, who frustrates us, who angers us? You have been forgiven. I have been forgiven. Let us forgive so that everybody has an opportunity to experience closeness and connectedness with Jesus. Let me pray.